can't take history there.
Can't. Oh, you can. Oh, yes. You can major in history in there.
Well, but I was a graduate student at Stanford and took a course in history. Imagine in electrical engineering. But I did my thesis at Harvard and was learning to be an astronomer in the course of it. And so I got into the OH scheme in a very complex way. First of all, there's an electrical engineering meeting in Boston every year, the NAREM meeting.
Yeah, right, I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
And there was a, I was a session organizer for talks on radio astronomy, often given from a kind of engineering point of view, but sometimes.
Now, what era are we talking about now? What year?
Well, that was in the early 60s. And in 63, in November, one of the papers I managed to organize was Arno Penzias's description of his search for OH in emission at Bell Labs, which was unsuccessful.
Okay, now, I wasn't even aware of this search. I know about some others, but he had tried to do this at Bell Labs.
Yeah, well, for me, the OH business started in about October 1st, or late in September of 63, and Ed Lilly had a preprint of the MIT effort at Millstone Hill, where they made the first detection of OH in absorption. And almost coincident with the appearance of the paper, in fact, somewhat before it was published in Nature, the there was this paper by Arno Penzias given at an NAREM meeting describing a negative result.
I see. That was that ever published anywhere besides NAREM record?
No, NAREM record is the only place, but that is a kind of publication.
Sorry, I didn't know about that reference, though. That's interesting.
You could look it up. Right. And so there I was as the session organizer, and I was the chairman. There were four papers. I can't remember the others right now. But I knew that OH had been detected, and here was one of my speakers that I had chosen who was saying that OH couldn't be detected, at least the way he was doing it. So that was an interesting position to be in. And I had, tried to query him a bit, and the MIT fellows were there at the meeting. Some, I think Sandy Weiner was one, Lit Meeks was another. And they didn't want to talk at all about their work because it was in publication in Nature, and they didn't want to speak until the publication actually appeared, which is
it did lead to the Australians.
Yes.
Lit Meeks told me about that.
Is that right? They started earlier. My really my first connection with this was a few months before I had visited MIT, and they were getting ready to detect OH. And I think they were willing to admit that they were getting ready to work on OH, and they had a multi-channel spectrum analyzer with a fairly narrow range and about 50 channels, and they tried it out on the hydrogen line at Millstone Hill, which was a very intelligent plan of action to make it work on something that's known before putting it on something that's unknown. And I'm not quite sure how I got out there. I think if my memory's right, Bob Price was one of the fellows who got me there. And we decided we'd go out to Millstone Hill and observe a hydrogen line. And I was the expert on the hydrogen line. I could tell them where to point the telescope and how to set the frequency. And so that was really a lot of fun. It turns out, though, that with the aid of several PhDs who did things like, one PhD had to set the oscillator frequency, and another guy could talk to the machine and point the telescope. It was a computer-controlled experiment, and the computer program was very inflexible. It had to do a very certain thing. So it was impossible to tell the machine to point at the source that I had in mind. I knew of a narrow, strong emission line that came from a large region in the sky, so that you didn't have to point with great precision. And to make a long story short, spending a whole afternoon at it, we were unable to get the thing pointed. They had no sidereal clock. That paralyzed me. But I called up Agassiz Station and got the sidereal time at Harvard, Massachusetts, which is very nearly the sidereal time at Millstone Hill. And we still failed. Well, so if you'd asked me then, could those guys do anything with OH, I'd have told you that I couldn't possibly. But that would be quite incorrect, because their detection of OH was a very workmanlike job, and the paper they wrote on it was really very conclusive. That is, if you read that, you could,
they got both lines,
you could scarcely doubt that it was a real detection, which wasn't always the case.
This interested you at Harvard, obviously.
Not at all. That is, I was a 21 centimeter observer.
I see. And interested Ed Lilly. Anyway.
But it interested Ed Lilly. That's true. As soon as they had a positive result, he was very much anxious to observe OH. And he asked, under what circumstances could we do it? And we had the Cooper, Jelly, Bloomberg, and Maser, which has a very narrow tuning range. Couldn't possibly be adjusted. The local oscillator wouldn't cover the right frequency range. And there are numerous other difficulties. But I thought that there was a good chance to observe OH with a crystal mixer type receiver or a tunnel diode by getting long integration times. Mm-hmm. And I had improved the Harvard receiver to make it possible to get long integration times. We had digital data processing then at a fairly early stage. There's analog processing first and then an A to D converter. Punched cards.
This is on the Agassiz 60 foot.
Yeah. And it was at that time a 5-channel receiver. I had tried to find 21 centimeter radiation from a globular cluster and used some long integration times just shortly before this project. And I had succeeded in getting theoretical noise for 10,000 seconds of integration. So the same length of time was quite adequate for observing what the MIT group saw with a crystal mixer receiver. So I advised Lilly to do that, but it was possible to improve things by using a tunnel diode receiver. And Arno Penzias had the tunnel diode that he had tried unsuccessfully to see emission with.
Now where had you tried that, and what telescope?
It was one of the, I think he calls it the 24 foot, it was one of the Bell Telephone Laboratories folded horns.
I see.
And of course, with a small horn, maybe it was a 10-foot. I get those two mixed up. With a small horn, only emission is possible. And he was anxious to check his observations to show.
Now, why was his search unsuccessful with hindsight?
Let's see.
Didn't look the right place.
The line is very weak in emission, and only visible, and so far is only seen in anomalous places, some H2 regions, and I guess in dust clouds also it's
right.
Been seen
yeah.
in emission. But it's the knowledge you have of the sky from the 21 centimeter hydrogen line just doesn't apply, because the excitation temperatures of the two materials are so different.
Right.
So in hindsight, he had chosen the wrong experiment.
He just didn't look in the right places for emission.
Well, his antenna, even today, knowing everything, it'd be extremely difficult to see it with a small telescope
right.
he was using. I think it's probably faintly possible.
With a broad beam.
So we took out the maser from the focus of the 21 centimeter receiver, the focus of the Agassiz 60 foot telescope, and that was quite a brave thing to do, because it had been a very powerful receiver and was still capable of good work. It was at that time the only 100 degree system in astronomy, I think. There were, the Bell Telephone Laboratories had a 30 degree system, but not on a big telescope.
Yeah.
And even not on a sizable telescope, a 60 footer was a.
So this was to retune
a good thing. So, what we eventually did was to make another maser, very similar to the first one, with a. But with a different piece of ruby and different cavity lengths, and I'll tell you about that after a while.
Okay.
But let's stick to chronological way. Order.
Right.
Lilly said, "What can be done to observe the OH line?" And I said, "Well, with Penzias's receiver, we should be able to get a good signal-to-noise ratio for the features that have already been seen." I was interested in the emission too. Since our 60-foot dish was smaller than their 84-foot dish, it looked like the direction to go. So we started up right away got another oscillator cavity and made it work at 18 centimeters. That was a fairly, just a couple of days work. And we operated switched load operation. We still used liquid helium even though our maser had been removed. Mm-hmm. And
so you were expecting just a couple of degrees signal. So I mean, you were...
Well, let's see. I think it works out to be between half and 1 degree. In our 25 kc filters, we're going to use 25 kc filters, roughly the line size. And it's Arno was there for a couple of weeks. We got the receiver mounted and going. I also started the work. I told the machinist who was there to begin making duplicates of the parts of the maser. It seemed like a good engineering principle not to tear up the very good old system, but merely to make duplicate ones. And he came to Agassiz Station every day and didn't have anything else to do. So.
Also, Ellen Runderman was involved in this, was she not?
Yes, not in this, not quite yet, but she was.
Okay.
She was a student there and was looking for a thesis, and I think she probably came to the project in December. Let's see. I remember she was certainly with it while I was working on the 18 centimeter maser, because she made an important contribution to my understanding of that. There was quite a crew there. There were two observers who pointed the telescope. And there was Ivan Johnson, two technicians, Ivan Johnson and Dexter Smith, who built the electronic things. The machinist, Karen, used to come out to the Agassiz station several times a week, mainly to maintain the optical things, but he was usually available to do mechanical things for us. And there was another technician, Glowacki, who maintained the 60-foot. He would lubricate the thing and did mechanical work on it.
And so when did you finally get the thing mounted?
It was...
first test or whatever.
Let's see. It was in... We began observing in mid-November, I think, on a temporary basis. And then the first really convincing observations came on November 23rd, or 22nd. That was the day Kennedy was shot. I was sitting...
the actual day of 63?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's an easy thing to remember. We'd had some preliminary observations that might have shown the effect, but I had three different two-hour-long observations, which... one of which had the...
Which source is this now?
This is the single feature in CAS A. We had the Perseus arm source, I guess it's called. On one of those records, there was a low point in the middle by design. On another record, there was nothing because we moved off the source. And for a third record, it had been moved over to the fourth channel instead of the third. You can understand that five-point spectra don't give
right.
you the most convincing possible presentation of what's happening, but having those three records, I think, would convince anybody, especially. You have also a theoretical signal-to-noise ratio and a kind of real one from the four points that
right.
you can see.
So which arm is it?
To give you an idea of what the signal-to-noise is, and there was the feature at more or less what you predict it to be from having read the paper by the MIT group. So
you mean the absorption feature?
Yeah, the single absorption feature on the day Kennedy was shot. And I was plotting those points when somebody yelled, "Hey, the president's been shot."
So this was that night before that you'd taken them, or that morning? Or?
Yeah. I remember taking these things to see Lilly a couple of days later. I described them on the phone to him more or less right away. Perhaps the third one that didn't actually exist that day. But I took this stuff to Lilly, and he was at his house, and he was watching the funeral of the president, which... I told him there's no doubt in my mind that we'd seen the effect, that they were right, the OH does emit, and that our present equipment...
Well, absorbed now.
Absorbed, thank you. This is really a Well, let's see, how does it go? Well, anyhow, I recommended, said we ought to build a maser for 18 centimeters. Arno's receiver was supposed to be 600 or 700 degrees, but it turned out to be 900 or 1,000. Still a bit better than the crystal mixer we'd have had. We needed considerable improvement. Arno had incidentally provided another gadget, which was very helpful to the project. He built a current-controlled attenuator, which allowed us to match the temperatures exactly. We put that in the reference arm. And that was a very, very nice thing. And so, as soon as we... Lily also thought it was very important to increase the number of channels, and I didn't really object to that. Five channels is clearly not enough.
Yeah.
And we had built a model of a cheaper and somewhat simpler phase detector, and we're ready to start constructing more. And but the key thing, it seemed to me, was the maser, and I didn't want to be committed to do those other things on any schedule, but I was willing to. Let's see, this is late 63. Anyway, we did start to work. We went to see Bloomberg and to ask for advice on the maser. I don't really understand the process of maser action in theoretical terms very well, but I understood how to build a cavity maser, and Lily wanted to see if to what extent Bloombergen would help, and he wanted to get Bloombergen's opinion of whether I could do it or not, I think. And so we had some discussion how to do it.
This receiver you're talking about now, this maser, was the one that the emission was detected with?
Yes, the one we started, yeah.
This one we can make sure of.
Yes. So anyhow, that was a lot of fun, building a maser. And
how long did that take?
Oh, it must have taken 3 or 4 months, trying to remember some of the
details. Was there any time pressure at this time? Did you know that Berkeley was also in this game?
Oh, yes, of course. Lily decided that it wasn't worthwhile publishing our evidence. It didn't. Man Dieter was then at Air Force Cambridge Research and went to Berkeley shortly afterwards. Let's see, it must have been the spring of 64. A group at the Air Force using a receiver that Harold Ewan, or using a preamplifier that Harold Ewan had found, published a paper on the OH. Pretty much the observation that checking MIT.
Oh, I didn't know. Where is this paper? Remember?
It's in Nature.
It's in Nature.
Okay. Ewan and Dieter and probably somebody else.
I remember that one.
And there's one by Weaver.
Yeah, the Weaver one.
About December, Nature. Late December, early January. Those papers are more or less simultaneous. We could have added to that one more.
So they were working on the OH even before Dieter got out there.
Oh, yeah.
Berkeley.
Yeah. But those papers didn't add very much.
Just confirmation.
The original paper was so conclusive that it hardly needed a kind of inaccurate confirmation.
Yeah, right.
So I don't place the time on this too accurately, but sometime in the spring of 64, we had the maser working, and by summer, working pretty well. And it had a performance very, very much like the original 21 centimeter maser.
You mean in the lab you had it working?
No, on the telescope.
On the telescope.
Yeah. Trying to think of how to date this. My wife and I and our kids went to Puerto Rico for a vacation, and it must have been May of 64. And it wasn't really working before that, although it. And it started working pretty soon after we returned.
So once it got working...
So the first thing we did with it was to... Well, we did look at Cas A.
Yeah.
And it got a better signal-to-noise ratio, but still, our resolution wasn't adequate.
Still had the 25 kilohertz.
That was the narrowest filters we had. We had 80 kilohertz, and we were then we then had increased to 10 channels. We were striving very hard to find emission, and so we picked a long path through the center. I think our point was L equals 4 and B equals 0.
Yes, and also, excuse me, by this time, Ellen Goodman was...
Yes, Ellen, joined Ellen had joined probably around Christmas time, and she was doing her thesis as soon as the thing began working. She was scanning three of the four transitions, and the maser could be fairly easily retuned.
Right. Which one was missing?
Let's see. I think she did 1612 and 1720 was missing, but I may have it backwards. Okay. So I think emission was our goal from an early stage, and one place that we looked at a lot was L equals 4, B equals 0, mm-hmm. a kind of minimum in the galactic plane with a long path length through the center. And eventually we saw not an emission there, but absorption. And we also looked at the galactic center, Sagittarius A, and we got a publication out of both of those two spectra. And it was Penzias and Gunderman and Lillian Goldstein on
In Nature?
In Nature. So that'll give you some date on the thing. I think that Gunderman's thesis, probably her thesis observations didn't begin until after that was done.
So you had the thing working. You've seen other absorption. And
yeah.
How did you get onto an emission source?
Well, let's see. Well, realizing the very different conditions that existed between hydrogen and OH, we started just exploring, looking at lots of sources. And I'm trying to think of the ones we looked at, all the standard bright sources. We looked at Virgo and Orion.
Crab.
Taurus. I don't remember Orion. No, I think it was. But, yeah. What were some of the others? This is probably going to overload your tape.
I'm just making sure, because when it runs out, you don't have any audible sign. And
I see.
Mm-hmm. And I have to turn it over.
Well, we saw absorption features in several of the sources and no emission in any of those directions. And trying to think of some of the others. Why don't you stop it for a second and see if I can't recall. One. I remember feeling that it was surprising that you could see a fairly strong feature in Cas and nothing in Cygnus. And I thought, what's different about these sources? One, they're both near the galactic plane. Cygnus is at roughly 90 degrees longitude, so there's a long path length through the spiral arm. My gosh, there ought to be something there. But we got pretty long integrations without much evidence. The hydrogen line is weaker there, too.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I wonder if galactic latitude could be the effect. Cygnus is 6 degrees out of the plane, and Cas is only two or two-tenths of a degree, I don't recall.
It's much closer.
One night I looked at several sources that were chosen just to be close to the galactic plane. By God, they all hit.
This is like Westerhout's catalog?
Yeah, and they came out of Westerhout's catalog. W51 was one of them. So the next thing I did was to go through Westerhout's list, and we had it. I would guess a dozen sources with OH absorption, which was quite a sizable catalog for those days. And W49 came out long after the first dozen. And we were using first 80 KC filters in this surveying. And Ellen called me up on the phone one day. Said she was in Cambridge then, and our machinery punched cards, and she would submit them to the computer and get the spectra. She said, "Sam, what's W49?" And I said, "It's the 49th source on Westerhout's list." And she says, "Well, we see strong emission."
This is with an 80 kilohertz filter.
Yeah, you
can 80 kilohertz filter.
And she said W51 probably has some too. It's not nearly as convincing. And we told Ed Lilly and started to work the next day on 25 KC filters. The procedure is that you give the observer the, a set of coordinates and the instructions, how long the integration, what the filter width is, what the frequency should be.
Yeah.
And he does all the rest. And the cards automatically go to Cambridge the next morning. I don't remember who took them. And Alan pilots it through the machinery. Especially in those days, I didn't know how to punch cards or how to feed the computer. And but we soon had we did all the usual things. We changed the settings. And
yeah. Went off the source.
Went off the source. And there's no question that it was real. It was a huge signal-to-noise ratio. We eventually got to 3 kilocycle filters, which I had bought the parts for, but never put together. But we had a big rush project to make 3KC filters. And by then, though, I was we reached. I don't think I gave the instructions anymore after the 3KC filters were completed. That is, this must have been into. This is in January of.
Now, had Berkeley published their thing?
No, the Berkeley publication was in June or something. I've probably got the date wrong. I don't. But there was a lot of complex things going on that affected the operation of the station. It was pretty well established that I was going. This was my last year there. I thought I was going to be leaving at the end of the year, but that would have been January 1st, 1965. But in fact, I left in June, and went to Charlottesville. So there was a lot of dissension between Lilly and myself, especially in those last days and preceding them. And I remember once while I was writing the during the time I was writing all the observing instructions for the crew there, which that probably stopped about the end of the year 64, that Ed apparently felt that he ought to play a more detailed part in the running of the station, especially since I was going to be going. So he called me in and said, Goldstein, let's make the observing schedule while I was, this is in Cambridge. And I said, geez, Lily, you can't make the observing schedule here. I need all kinds of data. I got to know the coordinates of all these sources and what the sidereal time is and such Eastern Standard Time, and all that's out on my desk at Agassiz Station. And he said, well, let's agree on what sources are going to be on the list tonight. as usual, and I would say, oh, come on, Ed. Geez, you can't, I can't tell that until I see what's available. And so he finally gave in. It was impossible to do even general instructions on what's to be observed without all the details in hand. And I used to do all that. So I got back out and wrote an observing schedule, as usual. And so what I was doing very much during my last year there was trying to amass data. And we made a survey with a traveling wave maser. We tried to find neutral hydrogen.
Your thesis, or
Virgo cluster? No, my thesis was long before that.
Okay, you were on there as a postdoc sort of thing.
I was a lecturer on astronomy and the radio engineer in the Harvard College Observatory.
I see.
And a research fellow. Three different appointments at Harvard in those days. So I had built a horn with the aid of the carpenters out there, Andy Russell Anderson and his nephew. It was designed, we called it the Virgo horn because it had a pattern in the sky calculated to be the same as the Virgo cluster. We set that up and stuck the traveling wave maser that Tracy had built at Bell Labs on it. That